Hey everybody, this is Chris with the Come This Far podcast with Chris Taylor. This episode of the podcast is brought to you by Robinhood.com. I know you have sat back before and wanted to get involved in the stock market. You've wanted to buy stock in Amazon, Microsoft, Google, GM, Facebook, Nike, Visa, Sony, Uber, Walmart, PayPal, Disney, Coca-Cola, GE, Apple, all of these companies that seem to be all over the place, Netflix, all of these ones, man. But you don't know how to go about it. You don't work on Wall Street. Hell, you probably don't even have a college degree. Who cares? It's the 21st century. Don't pay a commission to these losers that'll charge you 15% just to push a button from some high rise in New York City. Go to Robinhood.com today. Set up an account. It's easy as 1, 2, 3. Robinhood.com is investing for everyone. It's the easiest place to learn as you go, learn as you grow. Commission-free investing, plus the tools you need to put your money in motion. Sign up and get your first stock for free. Yeah, certain limitations apply, but that's okay. Break free from commission fees. Like I said, make unlimited commission-free trades in stocks, ETFs, and options with Robinhood Financial. And guess what? As well as buy the hottest cryptocurrencies with Robinhood Crypto. But how much is a Bitcoin today? One Bitcoin is like $33,000 regular dollars. I know you don't have that, but that's okay. Robinhood has fractional shares. You can invest in thousands of stocks and cryptocurrencies with as little as $1. Invest any amount. Choose how much you want to invest, and they will convert from dollars to parts of a whole share. Amazon costs like $3,300 for one share. Don't have $3,300 laying around? Maybe you only have $33? Well, you'll get $33 worth of a $3,300 stock. It's called a fractional share. You can build a balanced portfolio this way. You can invest in a whole wide variety of companies, and you can customize your portfolio with pieces of different companies and funds to help reduce risk. You can also trade in real time. All trades placed during market hours are executed at that time, so you'll always know the share price. You can also keep tabs on your money. You can set up a customized news and notifications to stay on top of your assets as casually or as relentlessly as you like. Controlling the flow of info is up to you. You get to manage your portfolio. You have your portfolio in your pocket, in your smartphone. Everything you need to manage your assets is available in a single app, and you don't have to deal with any loser elitist on Wall Street that isn't any smarter than the person on the corner selling bagels, but because he has a college degree, he gets to charge you money to buy and sell stocks for you? That's nonsense. It's always been nonsense, but now it's the 21st century and you have Robinhood.com, proud supporters of the Come This Far podcast with Chris Taylor. Enjoy the episode. You know, some people think that I tell my story to get praise or to, you know, be on the news or be on shows like this. And you don't realize how difficult it is to become so vulnerable and to open your family up to that scrutiny. But I know how important it is, because when a news segment airs, I get hundreds and sometimes thousands of comments and messages and people who are suffering in silence, and they tell me how much inspiration they get. And so I don't want my struggles and everything that I've suffered to be in vain. Like, I really believe that God gives people struggles and trials to overcome them and then to be that hope and help to other people.
And a Safford City Council member is suspending his campaign for Congress.
A Safford City Councilman has suspended his campaign for Congress after suffering a heroin overdose.
His name is Chris Taylor. You may actually know the name very well. It's been very publicized here in the Arizona media and the Arizona press.
Chris Taylor was running for the Republican nomination to challenge Democrat Tom O'Halloran this November.
And tonight, Chris Taylor says he is seeking treatment for substance abuse.
We first met Chris Taylor in 2017 as we dug in on the opioid opioid problem plaguing the eastern Arizona city of Safford.
In a previous campaign ad, Taylor opened up about his struggles with opioid addiction after two tours in Afghanistan.
Taylor, a veteran who fought off addiction to open his own treatment center, was poised to be the success story for Safford. But he went backwards as old demons resurfaced last week. A relapse that resulted in an overdose. In a statement to suspend his congressional campaign, Taylor was very direct, saying, quote, "I'm not going to hide from this. I'm not ashamed of what happened. I wish to sincerely apologize to the amazing people who have supported me. It's a haunting reminder of a dark past that will always be looking over the shoulder of a bright future."
All right, everybody. Welcome to the Come This Far podcast with Chris Taylor. I'm your host, Chris Taylor, and today we're going to jump right back into the next installment of the special series titled 12 Steps to Complete Healing, my personal journey through each step in recovery. And because these steps are meant to be worked continuously, and it's not just a one and done thing, I am going to jump back and forth and tell personalized stories regarding each step in the 12 steps of recovery. The first step I talked is honesty. I talked about my more recent experience, my near fatal overdose, and how I came to realization that I once again was powerless, and my life was unmanageable and I needed help. Step two is hope. Come to believe that the power of God can restore you to complete spiritual health. And so since after this last relapse, and overdose, I knew for a fact that, that God could and would restore me back to complete spiritual health. I knew that. And one of the reasons I knew that is because 7 years earlier, when I first, decided to change my life, to get the help that I needed. I had just returned from Afghanistan and got out of the military, honorably discharged at the end of my enlistment, was diagnosed with post-traumatic stress, had a back injury in combat, and I was prescribed oxycodone. And those of you who know my story know that My bouts with addiction before the military had to do with an injury, being introduced by innocent means to opioids for a back injury, and then dealing with trauma, coping with that trauma by self-medicating to numb the feelings of pain and trauma. And so in 2011, when I came home, I was spiraling fast. I knew that I needed help. I went to get help at the Phoenix VA. It took 9 months before I could even see a mental health professional. And even then, I didn't get the help that I needed. And so it was nearing October of 2013. I had been placed on felony probation after a very unjust and unwarranted criminal bout with the criminal justice system. Let's put it that way. I was still struggling. I needed help. And I wasn't receiving the help that I needed until finally the VA came through. I got a, I researched myself, the where I needed and what I needed. I had done the addiction recovery treatment. I had successfully completed intensive outpatient at the VA. I had successfully completed a stay at a halfway house. I had learned so much about recovery, but that unresolved trauma that I just couldn't process, didn't process, needed help, needed to deal with my post-traumatic stress. I researched a world-renowned program in Palo Alto, California, actually Menlo Park, California, and it was the Men's Trauma Recovery Program out of the Palo Alto VA healthcare system. Palo Alto, of course, is where Stanford University is located, and they are at the very cutting edge of treatment for processing trauma, post-traumatic stress, all that. And so I went to my doctor in Phoenix and said, I want to go to this program. Please make it happen. I pushed and pushed. And so finally I got a date, and it was 2 months out, and I really was struggling bad. I couldn't wait. I had relapsed again, and I started to spiral, and I knew that I needed to have a clean UA to get into the trauma recovery program. Because if I showed up with a positive test for opioids, they were going to send me to an addiction recovery program. And what happens, at least at that time in the VA, was when you present as a heroin addict, that's all they care about. That's all they want to know about. That's all they want to, and they just want to put band-aids on those symptoms. You know, the problem you have is you're an addict. And I knew that the reason that I was self-medicating was my trauma, and my post-traumatic stress. And so, I knew that I had to be clean. I knew that I had to abstain from heroin, from opioids, for at least 8 days, 9 days, so that when I got there, I would have a clean UA, and I could start this program that I so desperately needed. And so 8 or 9 days before my flight to San Jose, California, I did it. I stopped. I took my Suboxone. It was rough, but I got through it. And I had done my last dose of heroin, and it was like a burden lifted. Like, yes, I did it. I'm going to be clean. I can go. And a few days after that, that last dose, I realized that last dose, that last shot had initiated an infection in my arm. And any of you who have dealt with IV drug use know that is a especially with the black tar heroin and how dirty it all is. I wasn't using dirty needles, but it's just you just never know what's gonna be in those drugs. And for me, and I don't want to get too graphic because this is about the solution, not the problem, not the war stories or anything like that. But, you know, I had exhausted all of my veins, and I was using needles to do what's known as an intramuscular shot, just like a flu vaccine you get in your upper arm. And so that's where that infection was brewing, that it's staph infection or whatever. And oftentimes you get a little infected or sore in an injection site, and your immune system kicks in and it roots out that infection, and it just kind of goes away on its own. And so that's what I was crossing my fingers for and hoping for. And a few days later, I realized that was just not happening. That was not the case. And I, dang it, I, what am I going to do? So the night before, I was supposed to check into this program, the day before, my parents dropped me off at the Phoenix airport. I get on the flight. I am starting to feel so weak. I am flush. I am feverish. I am, I can barely walk through the airport. I am just not in good shape. But I don't tell anybody what's happening because I need to go into this program, and anything that's going to derail me is not going to be good. And so, I get on that flight, I check into a hotel outside of the VA there. And that night was the worst night that I probably have ever had. I was suffering from a very high fever, a very high pulse rate. I was taking so many ibuprofen 800s for the pain in my arm that was just immense. And my shoulder was triple the size that it was supposed to be. I couldn't move my arm. I was so weak that I couldn't move. I couldn't just, it was just horrible. I was having what's known as fever dreams, delirium, nightmares, but I was not getting any rest. Like, I was just laying there sweating profusely. I would be really, really cold and then really, really hot. It was like I was withdrawing from opioids, but I wasn't. I wasn't withdrawing it. I was on Suboxone, and I had gotten past that. I was 8 or 9 days past where I, you know, any of that would have ever happened. So I knew that was an infection in my arm that was presenting these symptoms, and that wasn't good. And so somehow that morning I wake up, get the cab to the program. I somehow walk in and I am in bad shape. And I'll never forget the nurse that was doing the in-processing for that trauma recovery program. She was young, probably 21 years old, beautiful young lady, just amazingly beautiful. In any other normal time, I would have been flirting with her, but I could not even hardly talk. I mean, it was bad, and I'm not exaggerating. And she takes my vitals, she looks at me, and she's like, let me do that again. She does it again. She's like, huh. She's really like perplexed. She leaves the room. She comes back with the program doctor, the MD, and they run my vitals, and he's like, huh. And I'm like, what's the problem? I know what the problem is, but I'm like, what's going on? And she looks at me, the nurse, and she says, well, your vitals, how are you alive right now? That's what she said. And I'm just like, I don't know. I don't know how I'm alive, but I am. And so the doctor says, well, what's going on? Are you withdrawing with this? And I said, no. Have you got the results of my test? And they said, yes, you're provided a negative test. You're clean. So what's going on? And that's when I tell him, like, look, I have an infection in my arm. He looks at it and he's like, we got to get you to the emergency room. You have a high 104.8 fever. Your blood pressure is very, very low. At this point, it was low. My pulse was just so out of whack. And they literally rushed me to the ER. I get to the ER. They start doing all the x-rays and MRIs and tests. I'm in such immense pain. So it was just so painful. So this infection is growing in my shoulder, and the pressure of it. It's just like, but it's so deep in there that it's not coming to the surface like a abscess would, where you can just lance it. And no, this was deep. And they call in a world-renowned orthopedic surgeon from Stanford University Medical School. He does a consult. He determines, and he comes and talks to me and says, son, I'm going to be very honest with you. You have one of the worst infections that I have seen, and it has entered your bloodstream, and you are suffering from septic shock. You are septic. You have sepsis, and the infection, we believe, has spread, and it has reached your bone and the muscle, obviously. And we are quite certain that, in my professional experience, that there's a better than not chance that are going to have to amputate your arm. And at the very least, if we don't amputate, we'll have to take out so much of the deltoid muscle that your arm will be useless. Basically, he said these words. He said, you'll never be able to throw a football or a baseball. You'll never be able to shoot a basketball. And this is devastating to me, because I've always wanted a family with kids, with a son, with a daughter that I could teach, and the love of sports that I had, that I have. And what he was saying to me was so, it just hit so hard. And I thought, how did I get here? It was the most hopeless and helpless that I have ever been. And because I was on the Suboxone that blocks all opioids, the morphine they were giving me for the pain wasn't doing anything, because it blocks that. And so the pain was so immense, and they couldn't give me anything. I was in a nightmare, a living hell. They rushed me into surgery. And because of my situation, with the blood pressure, with the white blood cell count, with the medicine I was on for the Suboxone, they had to call in like a team of anesthesiologists to figure out what they were going to do. And they determined that they could not put me under. They could not put me out for a surgery that probably they were going to have to amputate my arm at the shoulder. And so they call in this guy. He brings in a needle. It's like this big. I'm not lying. It's a nerve block. And he puts it into my neck, all the way in, and everything just goes completely numb all on my right side. And they say, that's what we do. They gave me a benzodiazepine that kind of calmed my nerves, but didn't put me out at all. And so I'm awake the whole time, and they're just treating like my arm like a rag doll. It's like up over my shoulder, and I can feel it moving, but I can't feel anything. And they're in there. It feels like they have one of those car wash pressure washer things that they're just like, you can hear it. It's like, and the surgery lasts a couple hours. The surgeon leaves. They sew me up. They take me to the recovery. And at this point, I kind of wake up because I was a little, I kind of had taken a little nap or whatever. And I realized that both of my arms are still there. And so that was kind of a good sign. The doctor comes in, and he sits down, he looks at me, and he says, son, if you have any religious belief at all, you need to thank your God what I've just experienced in my all of my years. And at this point, they have a room full of residents and experts and Stanford University medical students, because it's like they're it's like a teaching moment. It's so unreal to them, like what the infection was and the results of the surgery. And he's telling me that it's a miracle. There's no ifs, ands, or buts. We got in, and as bad as the infection looked on all of the imaging and what it looked like, and in all of our expertise, you should not have an arm right now. But not only that, we were able to clean out the infection, and your muscle is still intact. But you are not out of the woods because of the sepsis, because of the infection that got into your bloodstream. They took a culture of the infection that they cleaned out of my arm, and it was tested for positive for cultures of like a super bacterial mixture of strep and staph. And they said, you're going to be in the ICU for probably a week or more. You're still touch and go. They had a crash cart in my room at all times. They had my vitals. They had somebody there checking them all at all times. The antibiotic that they had me on was so powerful. It's called vancomycin. And they had to take blood every 2 hours to check the levels to make sure, because too much or a wrong level could kill me, because it was there to take out that bad infection that had reached my bloodstream. And you know, I was 26 years old, 25 years old, 26. If I would have been 40 or any older than that, I would be dead. And that's just, they said, that's just clear. I mean, but you are young, you're relatively healthy. You are going to have a tough battle this week, but you know, we think that you have a good chance of making it. And nobody knows that I'm here. I don't tell my parents. They know that I'm in the trauma recovery program. I told them before I went into surgery, I texted them and said, hey, they're taking my phone. I'm not going to have my phone for a couple weeks. I just didn't want anybody to know. When I get into that ICU room after the surgery, and after I can kind of process everything that has just taken place, I get down on my knees, and for the first time in my life, I humbly and sincerely plead with my Father in heaven . I surrender my entire will. I can't do it anymore. I am powerless. Step two, it says, when we realized our powerlessness over our addictions, most of us felt stripped of any hope. Those of us who had grown up with no concept of God were certain that we had exhausted every avenue of help. Meanwhile, those of us who believed in God, which was me, were convinced that he was too disappointed in us to help. Either way, step two presented us with an answer we had either never considered or else had discarded: to turn to God and find hope in the atonement of Jesus Christ. Finally, humbled, we reached out for help. Following what felt to us like the tiniest ray of hope, when I finally reached that point, that I have tried everything else. I have been prideful. I'm a soldier, a special operations soldier. I've survived so much. I don't need help. I don't need any help from God. I can do this. And look where that got me. And so finally, with absolutely no hope, I abandon all of my pride and all of my will and just say, I need you. And I can honestly say, immediately, I felt a comfort and a warming sensation, a literal lifting of that burden off of my shoulders. I felt the love of my Savior Jesus Christ envelop me. I felt his arms around me. And for the first time in so long, I felt like there was hope. I began to feel that healing power. If there was hope for others who had been at the very brink of destruction, maybe there was hope for us too. In this program, I knew that hope had to be followed up with action. And I knew that there were things that I would have to do that would be hard and that would be at times feel insurmountable. But I no longer felt hopeless. And I began to work these steps. I came to a realization that I needed my Savior to restore me to complete spiritual health. And I was willing and I was ready. And the next several months were life-changing. I successfully completed the trauma recovery program. I returned home, and within weeks, I met my wife. We got engaged, we got married, started a family, had a beautiful baby girl. I started a successful nonprofit organization, became a certified firefighter. I ran for city council and became an elected official at 30 years old. I was able to pass what I had learned on to countless individuals and see that same miracle work in their life. After several years of just smooth sailing, I got to a point where I thought that I was so far past that insanity, I had been healed, and I had. I really had. But I allowed my pride to creep back in. I allowed myself to grow complacent. And I stopped working these steps continuously. And I fell back down farther and faster. And it hit me like blindsided me. But now I know that I have to work these steps continually. I have to go back and do them again and again. And each time I do, I feel that same healing power. Step two is hope. Never lose hope.